the local musical talent here in southeastern Wisconsin by playing their music. So if you're a local musician and you have a CD or MP3 of your professionally recorded songs, we'd like to hear from you and get you on Noon Tunes. Call me, Dave McGrath, at 564-3880 or email me at mcgrathd@gtc.edu. We'll talk and get you on the air. We feature a song by a local artist on Noon Tunes at the end of every WGTD Midday Newscast. Be listening then.
On the next Fresh Air, U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo. She's the first American Indian appointed to the position. She has a new memoir that's in part about her family's history. Her great-grandfather survived what became known as the Trail of Tears, the forced relocation of Indians from their native land. Join us.
Fresh Air, tonight at 7 on WGTD.
WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
Now 11 minutes after 8, the morning show is up here in just a couple of seconds. Let's take a quick check on sports and weather. Major League Baseball, the Phillies hit 6 home runs as they shut out the Brewers 12-0 yesterday. Cubs lost to the Cincinnati Reds 4-3, and the White Sox were off. Tonight, the Brewers and Phillies again up at AmFam Field, Cubs and Cincinnati again down at Wrigley, and the White Sox are in Kansas City. Now, the Tuesday forecast from the National Weather Service, partly sunny, very warm and windy, 70% chance of rain, most likely this afternoon. Today's high 86, winds between 15 and 25 miles per hour. So here are the numbers right now. Wind is southwest at 13, humidity still high at 76%. Pretty good cloud cover, 72 degrees in Kenosha, 71 now for Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 12 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Our morning show guest scheduled for today is missing thus far. We hope he is en route. In the meantime, here is an interesting interview that comes from the Morning Show archives. I'm excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show because we're going to be talking about a fascinating book that examines something that now we take completely for granted. But once upon a time, it marked something of a revolution. In the words of the author Scott Woolley in his book, The Network, we're talking about a new revolution at hand that would vastly increase the value of the invisible waves in the air. This revolution came early in the 20th century when we began to understand that we could send signals not just through cables, but over the air via invisible sound waves. And this was a breakthrough which marked the creation of both radio and ultimately television. And there were two great geniuses at the heart of this development. First, an inventor by the name of Edwin Armstrong, and then a gentleman by the name of David Sarnoff, who was really responsible more than any other single person for implementing these new technologies in extraordinary ways. But it was ultimately a battle between the two of them for, in a sense, primacy, for control over this new technology and how it would emerge. And particularly when a new technology of FM radio was developed by Mr. Armstrong, which threatened to unseat AM radio, which was already in place. This really, in a sense, finally doomed what had been a friendship, maybe an increasingly uneasy friendship, between these two geniuses. Hence this fascinating book called The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. The author is Scott Woolley, who has written extensively for a number of different magazines and journals like Fortune and Slate and Forbes, and he is responsible for this fascinating new book, which is published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins, again called The Network. Scott Woolley, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Glad to be talking to you. I especially enjoy books that explore technologies that now are so much a part of everyday life, every moment of our lives, that we completely take them for granted. Talk for a moment about both the challenge and the pleasure of examining something like the emergence of these new technologies that we read about in The Network.
Well, it is this fascinating combination of these electromagnetic waves that carry all this information, being invisible. They're always around us, and yet they're unseen. As you say, we just ignore them, and yet they're constantly becoming more powerful. And one of the ways I got into this story is I was covering the modern wireless technology, and you think about what's happened with the power of the airwaves and what your smartphone can do today versus a decade ago when you probably didn't have a smartphone. You know, this pace of wireless technology advance is really seems astounding, and yet when you go back and look 100 years ago when people first started to try to master these waves and control these waves, the leaps in progress were even greater and more mind-bending for people. I mean, some of the things your iPhone 6 can do are certainly amazing, the way it can track you and do all these other things. But 100 years ago, when David Sarnoff and Edwin Armstrong first became friends, the mere ability to send a message at the speed of light 100 miles and have someone receive a little text message, before there was the radio as we know it, there was the radio telegraph, and that was, it seemed like magic. I mean, you can only imagine at the beginning of the 20th century, the ability to communicate instantly with people on the other side of the planet didn't seem, you know, like anything that would ever be possible.
And I think one of the best things you do in your book, even though in a sense your book isn't primarily about this, but you really help us understand the sense of wonder that that was generated by this technology that now seems entirely ancient, of undersea cables through which one could send these signals, for instance, across the Atlantic. That was such a wondrous thing in and of itself, and it means that it's little wonder that there were plenty of people who were perfectly complacent, perfectly satisfied with that being the means of communication over vast distances. And it really took someone of enormous vision to realize that, as wondrous as that was, there was something even more wondrous waiting just around the corner, but as yet unseen.
Yes, I didn't know much about the sort of undersea telegraph cables that were kind of the first World Wide Web. They used to call it the nervous system of the British Empire. The ability to communicate across oceans with these cables was a huge advantage to the British stock traders at the beginning. There were flash boys. The Michael Lewis idea of stock trading, there was the sort of 1900 version of that. So these cables were incredibly valuable and powerful, and then along comes people like Sarnoff and Marconi and Armstrong with this idea of building a worldwide web of waves in the air and communicating around the globe wirelessly. And so that turned into this huge fight, and there's a fascinating parallel today with Elon Musk has come out with this proposal to replace all the fiber optic cables that now run under the oceans with lasers in space shot between satellites. And so this is one of Elon Musk's many amazing and remarkable ideas. But it's neat that the fight goes on between whether we're going to be sending our information around the world through wires under the ocean or waves in the air. But the 1900 version of this fight I knew nothing about, and really led to the birth of this relationship between Armstrong and Sarnoff.
Right. Mr. Sarnoff actually goes to work for the Marconi Wireless Cable Company after first working, sorry, the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company after having worked at the Commercial Cable Company. And we should just say a quick word about this intriguing gentleman named Marconi and what prompted him to explore this notion of wireless communication and the kind of hurdles which he had to surmount.
Well, I really came to a different conclusion about a few of the characters in the book as opposed to their general historical reputation. Marconi is often billed as the father of radio, the guy who invented radio, and he does have this famous moment in 1901 where he's in Canada, and he says he receives the first wireless message from across the ocean. And that becomes a big controversy because Thomas Edison doesn't believe him and basically calls him a liar. But then he manages to convince everybody, and what he really does in this sort of, and his Marconi's real talent was getting people on board, raising a lot of money, and then hiring a lot of other scientists who could make the technology work. So he's a fascinating character, and he's half charlatan, half business genius. So that and an absolutely critical figure to the birth of the wireless industry.
Absolutely. Just say a quick word about why there is a chapter in your book devoted to the Titanic. How does the Titanic and the sinking of the Titanic figure in this story? It's interesting.
Sure. Well, so in 1912, 1914, the wireless telegraph existed, but it was sort of seen as a joke because the regular telegraph was always better. And so when people believed, oh, okay, you can send messages a couple hundred miles through the air, but who cares? It's not really good for anything. Then along comes the Titanic, and there are two Marconi operators on the Titanic, and as it starts to sink, they send out an emergency message, which is why the Carpathia manages to show up and save 700 people. So in the midst of this, huge tragedy, all of a sudden, Marconi himself and his company become heroes. It's the one bright spot, and wireless technology, wireless communications, goes from being seen as sort of a joke or a parlor trick to this critical power that mankind can use in situations like this. So the Titanic, and the Marconi Company, by the way, was almost about to go bankrupt, or the American Marconi Company was struggling to raise money. So it comes at this perfect time for Marconi and really establishes the airwaves as a powerful and important tool for humanity.
As you write, as soon as word of the Marconi operator's role in summoning the Carpathia to the Titanic reached New York, the grief-stricken city embraced Guglielmo Marconi as a hero. The power and value of the airwaves had been seared into the minds of the nation. So it's really at this point in the book, the second portion, which you title Invaluable, that we first see Richard Sarnoff and Edwin Armstrong joining forces, in a sense, to at least initially, to rescue a portion of Marconi's company. What was the problem, in a sense, that they were going to try to solve?
Well, the problem was that Marconi in 1901, when he said he'd sent a message across the Atlantic, was almost certainly lying, because the technology certainly didn't work. And so he claimed he'd heard one letter come in from across the ocean. But so he, based on that, said he was going to put all the transatlantic cable, telegraph cables out of business. So 13 years later, he still hadn't done it, because the technology, in fact, did not work. And what Armstrong invents is the vacuum tube amplifier that was able to take these weak airwaves from across the ocean and multiply their power by a thousandfold or more. And all of a sudden, that really makes radio possible. And it makes the idea of going into competition with the transatlantic cables possible. That's the first very valuable wireless business. So it's this key invention that this unknown 22-year-old in New York makes. And then, because nobody believes it's possible, one of the only people who's willing to give it a shot is David Sarnoff. So he hooks up this deal to go down to the Marconi's big antenna in New Jersey. And so he and this unknown inventor go down there one night, and they have this magical moment where they connect this vacuum tube amplifier to these big antennas, and all of a sudden, for the first time, they hear, clear as a bell, telegraph messages streaming in from Germany and Hawaii. They're in New Jersey, so basically the entire planet. And these two friends, for the first time, and they're the first people in the world to really fully understand the power of the airwaves to connect the world.
One of the things that's quite intriguing is when you tell the story of how Guglielmo Marconi himself, for as anxious as he had to be for some kind of a breakthrough like this to occur, was at least initially quite dismissive of what they were claiming to have achieved.
It's funny, and yes, one of Sarnoff's real talents was that he never
And that's a rather unexpectedly abrupt end to that interview, and that is with Dan Roberts, the author of The Network. We have a second interview coming up in just a moment. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's morning show, as with part one, is from the Morning Show Archives. The name of the book at hand is An Elegant Defense, and I think most people would not ever guess what the subtitle is or what this book is actually about from those intriguing first three words. An Elegant Defense, the extraordinary new science of The Immune System, A Tale in Four Lives. This is an extraordinary book by a Pulitzer Prize-winning author by the name of Matt Richtel. And in this book, Matt Richtel, a reporter for the New York Times, explores the hidden and, to some extent, still mysterious intricacies of our body's immune system and some of the key players and also some of the chief ways in which the immune system of the human body can go awry and actually cause us terrible problems. And as a matter of fact, those numbers are rapidly on the rise. More and more people are suffering from various disorders related to the misbehavior, if you will, of our body's immune system. And Matt Richtel has explored all of this in illuminating fashion and writes about these complicated matters in a way that even those of us not all that scientifically gifted can actually understand. So it is a very impressive achievement indeed. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner for national reporting for a series of articles about distracted driving that sprang from one of his first books, A Deadly Wandering. And his work has appeared in many, many different places. This book is published by William Morrow, again titled An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System, A Tale in Four Lives. Matt Richtel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, well, I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you for that really gratifying opening as well.
I think it is no small matter, no small feat, let's say, to write about complicated scientific information in a way that is going to make sense to someone who is not a scientist or well-versed in the sciences. Can you take us inside that challenge and what kinds of things you thought about as you crafted this book?
Yeah, well, I'll actually start at the end. I got this, in the acknowledgments, I note this very well-known immunologist among many, many I had the privilege of interviewing. And I said to him at one point, why are you, Dr. McCune, why are you spending so much time, your valuable time, explaining all this complicated science to me? And he said, Matt, I'm trying to create the most glib immunologist who ever lived. And I said, why is that? And he said, because someone has to explain to people what it is we do. And, you know, it turns out that this science, the science of the immune system, has exploded. So much so, Greg, that there is an argument to be made that it is the center of all medicine and clinical work right now. And it has long been a backwater. So to answer your question more directly, when I began to understand that the centrality of this to health, longevity, happiness, I basically put on my pith helmet and I started digging and digging and digging and committed myself to trying to understand this system in the first place and then to try to meet the commitment I made to all those people I interviewed, which was to be as accessible as humanly possible. And it was a 3-year project.
Hmm. I think one of the interesting choices you made was something that gives the book a certain frame that it otherwise would not have. And that is told in the last 5 words of your second subtitle, A Tale in Four Lives, that this is a book not only about this wide and complex sort of scientific discipline, but it is also wrapped around the personal stories of 4 different people for whom the immune system is a very crucial player for good or for ill. Explain the place of these 4 lives within this wider story.
Yeah. So in brief, I will tell you about the one that launched this whole project and then answer the question more broadly. I had a friend named Jason from high school who was Mr. Everything at the time. This is eons ago. All-state baseball, all-state basketball, great-looking guy, got all the girls. About a few years ago when we were in our 40s, he got lymphoma, cancer, and it's the kind that's supposed to be curable, but it was not. And after 3 to 4 years of radiation and chemotherapy, he had 15 pounds of tumor in his back. And his oncologist in Denver, we grew up in Colorado, said to him, Jason, I love you, man, but it's time to go home and die. And he went into hospice. And at the last second, even in hospice, he took this off-label, not yet for the market, immunotherapy drug. And a couple weeks after he took it, and again, remember, he's got nine toes in the grave here, his girlfriend woke him up and said, Jason, you're not going to believe this. Your tumors have disappeared. Wow, full stop, man rises from grave. And I'm his buddy and a New York Times science reporter, and I pick up my pen and I say, okay, not just what is immunotherapy, what is the immune system? So now to answer your question, he became one character, and he's a character whose immune system, in effect, was insufficient to fight the disease it faced. But I realized that the spectrum of the immune system and its impact on us is so broad that to make this accessible, I needed characters who represented other aspects of it. So here's Jason with an insufficient immune system, if you will. Then I picked two women who have autoimmune disorders, and their immune systems are too powerful. Their immune systems attack themselves. So if you think of this as Goldilocks, one had, or the Goldilocks story, Jason had too much, too little, these women had too much. And then I found this remarkable character, Greg. His name is Bob Hoff. He has, in effect, a perfect immune system, so good that the NIH studies his immune system to figure out how it works so well. And these gave us an emotional insight and a personal intimate touchstone for all the scientific theory in the book.
It's a great choice, and I think it helps us understand what is going on here so very, very well. Before we talk about the immune system, I want to spend a moment talking about this really unsettling phenomenon of the rapid rise in immune disorders that are just the scourge of so many people's lives. I can think of, I'm a voice teacher also outside of the radio station, and I can think of two of my finest former voice students who are both battling the effects of Crohn's disease right now. And of course, there are a number of other disorders as well that are related to an immune system sort of gone amok or rapidly growing and attacking the body instead of protecting it. What are the most important theories at the moment as to why we are seeing so much more of this than we once did?
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Are those men or women?
Men.
They're men. Interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I remember you saying that we do see more women than men in general suffering from these autoimmunity disorders.
Largely disproportionate women. And actually, I realize you preface this with by suggesting that we define the immune system after, but it might help if I defined the immune system before, because it will help explain why these very traumatic and very vexing and frustrating illnesses are on the rise. Would you indulge me with a little bit of scientific background here?
I think that actually makes a great deal of sense.
Okay. Sorry. Forgive me for, I always take my cues from you, but I realize as you were asking the question, I thought, I'm going to have trouble getting there. So let me...
Yep.
Let me start with this most basic idea, which is that I brought a lot of misconceptions into this book. In fact, I would say more than anything I've written, and you know, I'm an old saw journalist at this point, or an old horse. I was just one misconception after the next, and maybe the most basic one had to do with what the immune system is and does. So I brought into this book the idea that the immune system is this zealous police fighter that would just get everything alien out of our system and do it with ruthless efficiency. That was my idea, and there is some part of that that's true. To illustrate the immune system, I'm going to make a movie reference here. Do you remember The Matrix?
Oh yes.
Okay, so remember at some point these characters realize that there's ones and zeros all around them, that they live in a world populated by computer code, but it comes across as all these ones and zeros around them. Well, analogously, one of the first and most important principles to think about with regard to the immune system is the world that it exists in. And if you look around you, if you look on your desk, your computer monitor, your microphone, if I look at the cup of coffee that I'm holding on my shirt, we are covered in microbes. We are covered in bacteria, in parasite, in virus. Here's the thing, Greg. Most of these would do us no harm. So we are living in an alien world, or rather, we share the world with alien organisms. And for us to survive, and this is just absolutely crucial, we must mostly get along with the creatures that surround us, are on us, and are inside our gut to the point where half the cells in our body are not human. Does that conception make sense to start?
That's helpful, I think, yes.
Okay, perfect. So now, here's your defense network inside you. It's more than your defense network. Arguably, it is your everything network. It is the thing that keeps you alive and participating in the world. And its chief job is not to attack everything that is alien. If it did that, we'd be scorched earth. Its chief job is to try to get along as well as possible, and then only attack when necessary, and when attacking, do so with precise violence that does as little collateral damage as possible. I tend to think of the immune system not as a war machine, but more like a peace machine, and more precisely, like the love child of a bouncer and a ballet dancer. It is trying, can be extremely powerful, but it would like to do so on tippy toes.
Hmm. So that's the delicate balancing act that is part of a properly functioning immune system.
Among other reasons, that is the name of the title, An Elegant Defense. It is a fiercely, fiercely elegant defender of our body.
Right.
It almost is an oxymoron.
And of course, even beyond what you have just described, one of the wonders of the immune system is that it also has to be able to respond to things that it has never seen or encountered before. You, in the opening of the chapter called The Infinity Machine, you paint a scenario of somebody going off to some other exotic location, and
yes,
the body is suddenly encountering perhaps bacteria that it never has before. And how does the immune system manage to respond, in a sense, to brand new and completely unfamiliar enemies? You call this the infinity problem. But under the best of circumstances, the body's immunity system solves this problem.
I mean, I get shivers when you say that, because this is one of those chapters and subjects where the marvel of this thing here, I'm going to make the sound of my head exploding. That's what it sounded like when I learned how the body prepares to face an enemy never seen, and maybe that has never appeared before. And that has to do with the way the genetics of our immune system scramble up to create a virtually infinite number of possible scenarios. But I just want to point out that that is a marvelous piece of this. Let me go back now to how this connects to autoimmune disorders. So you've got this very finely tuned system, or rather, you've got a system that is constantly trying to strike the most delicate balance. And what happens is that you can imagine, given the complexity of the world, it is relatively easy. I mean, not a given, but relatively easy for it to lose balance. Imagine, for instance, you get a virus and your body responds to it, and the immune system reacts a little too violently, and there's residual effect, and it begins to continue to fight even after the virus is gone. I mean, I'm sure you've had those experiences where you get sick and you feel like you're over it, and yet you have lots of fatigue, low-grade fever. This could be existing residual inflammation as the body seeks to get back into balance or homeostasis again. But let's take the more extreme case in the rise of autoimmune disorders. A couple of things to say about it. What is an autoimmune disorder? An autoimmune disorder is where this finely tuned system becomes imbalanced such that it attacks either the body or it attacks something inside. In the case of allergy, it attacks, I'm going to lump these together, it attacks something that's actually not that threatening as if it was threatening. So a peanut allergy, you might have the body attacking in a way far disproportionate to the actual threat, and you could die from that. In an autoimmune disorder like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or Crohn's or go down the list, the body is reacting to itself as if it were an alien organism. I refer to these folks in the book historically as the invisible sufferers. The thing inside them was invisible because it was only them, and society treated them as if they were invisible. How many times have you heard the phrase, maybe it's in your head, you're acting a little hysterical, why don't you get a little rest? It's quite cruel, because just because the thing is invisible doesn't make it any less real. So I'll work my way around to why these are on the rise, but does that part make sense so far?
Absolutely.
So one of the reasons these are on the rise, well, first of all, we don't fully understand why they're on the rise, but there are some reasons that may be actually less related to our environment and more related to a couple simple, simple factors, like we are living longer. The longer we live, the more opportunity there is for this system to get out of balance. We are, in many respects, outliving what the immune system evolved to defend us for. And so if you think about what the immunologist will say is, we were meant to get an effect to reproductive age and somewhat beyond. And you can make a pretty good case, and the book makes this case, and I won't belabor it here, but that the immune system actually is part of killing us off individually to save the species. But as we live longer, there's more of a chance for the body to get out of whack. We are also beginning to see these things for what they are, meaning there may have been much more autoimmune disorder than we realized, and we called it you're tired, or we called it, but make no mistake, this is well, well beyond that. But then there's other factors that may be contributing. For instance, the super hygienic environment we live in, and this pertains more to allergy than to autoimmune disorder, but as you can see, they are cousins in that they represent an overreaction of the immune system. But we live, certainly in the developed world, in an increasingly and arguably overly hygienic world. What does that mean? Well, remember I had that, so again, I don't want to be long-winded. Are you with me so far?
Yes,
or is
sure.
Everyone fallen asleep?
Go for it.
Okay, so remember I was talking about all those ones and zeros around us, the microbes, not pathogens. Pathogens are more deadly ones. Microbes are just all the things around us, broadly speaking. We need those. Our immune system needs those inputs from those microbes in order to learn how to calibrate when to bounce and when to ballet, when to tiptoe lightly and when to attack. It learns. It goes to boot camp on all those microbes that are around us. Well, as we have sanitized our environment, now, I'm not talking about washing your hands before you eat or after you go to the bathroom or, you know, really basic stuff that is essential and I don't want to discourage anyone from doing. But when we start pouring the goop on our kids, on ourselves, every time we touch a banister or get on a bus or walk outside, and believe me, I've got 8 and 10-year-olds. I know what it means to pour the goop on them. What we've done is we have starved our immune systems of the inputs necessary to be very good at calibrating the environment. So in our household, despite the fact, maybe I shouldn't say despite the fact, maybe because of the fact, my wife's a doctor, I've learned all this, we have cut way back on the goop. And we've basically said, you know, sometimes we may get a head cold. Sometimes we may get a mild virus. Sometimes we may get an infection. But that is part of the healing process overall. It is part of the learning process for our immune system over the long run. And there's a good case to be made that allergies are on the rise because we are starving the body of its calibration tools.
In other words, we are living, in a sense, too cleanly, and that a little bit of dirt, a little bit of bacteria, actually quite a lot of bacteria, is actually necessary in order for this system to properly function. One of the ways in which my eyes lit up when I first read about your book was when you said something about how it's okay for children to eat dirt. I ate dirt when I was a child, and fortunately, my family's forward-thinking doctor thought that was perfectly fine, and so I was allowed to continue to do that. I'm not sure for just how long, but you tell us that that's actually not the worst thing that somebody can do to their body.
Look, think about it in an evolutionary sense. Our industrial processes of cleansing are less than 100 years old. But our evolution in our body evolved under circumstances far different. Now, again, I don't want to be cavalier about the processes. I quote Exodus in the book. Ritual hand washing was mentioned in the Bible. Many religions were cautious about eating certain animals because they confer a lot of bacteria. So I'm not saying it was great to be surrounded by filth, if you will, but we have overcorrected. Here's my mantra: hygiene, not hysteria. I think that's a way to think about how to treat your immune system properly.
Why is stress something that you talk about in your book as an important factor in the functioning or lack of function of the immunity system? Why should stress matter?
Yeah, so there's a few concrete suggestions at the end of this book, but they're made with some pretty deep science, and stress is probably the most evocative one, and I'm glad you brought it up. So I want to explain the relationship between stress and the immune system by taking us all back to our forebears. If you imagine the version of you 50,000 years ago. So just picture yourself just a lot hairier, and you're running across the savanna from a lion. And in that moment, your body is shifting a lot of resources, and they're being shifted to survive the lion attack, and they're not so worried about any kind of chronic thing. In other words, the lion's much scarier than the head cold at that point. And so your immune system gets, we shift our resources, internal resources, away from the immune system. In fact, it's not only a broad shift to put the resources towards surviving the acute threat. It's also because, as you know, when you're dealing with a cold, you feel tired. When you're dealing with a virus, you may have a fever. You will be alleviated of those symptoms so that you can survive the acute threat. This is because of a whole bunch of outpouring of chemicals like norepinephrine and epinephrine and cortisol. They're like superhero chemicals. But here's the problem. In today's world, so in that time, you are inviting infection to take hold, but only because you need to survive the more acute threat. Well, in today's world, we often feel like stress, the fight or flight experience that many of us have, we often interpret it internally as if there were a lion, but there is no lion. So the more we allow ourselves to get stressed, the more we create an acute threat that isn't so dangerous and meanwhile undermine our immune system. I will give you a very concrete example from 2 weeks ago. This book launched. It started on NPR. It soared to 16 on Amazon. Everything was exciting. I didn't sleep well for two nights. I got the flu. No one else in my family got the flu. it was such an object lesson. And incidentally, I should tell you, I was doing all the things I taught myself to do, and I couldn't make it work fully. But look, there was no lion. Far from it. This was all blessings, right? And I wound up giving myself the flu and had to withdraw very seriously for a few days in order to allow my immune system to get back into balance, because I had starved it. So there's more science in the book about stress and sleep, but it follows a lot along the same lines. There is no lion.
Last question. You are writing this book and have released it to the public at a point in time when our interest in this is really exploding, and it seems like new developments are occurring all of the time. Do you have some sense of where this is going, and in particular, the highest priorities of those who are working on a greater understanding of how our immune system works?
Yeah, I'm gonna give you three areas that I think are extraordinary, and that were we around, well, if we make it another 50 years or another 100, it's going to be, you know, on the order of flying cars. One is the microbiome, and we're just understanding that this bacteria that lives inside of us play an incredible role in our health. And the reason they do that is because they want us to survive. We are their home. But it's very hard to tease apart what the microbiome does, because it's lots of molecules all mashed up together inside of us, and the science is challenging. Number two is dementia and the brain. We're going to discover, and we are discovering, that the connection between inflammation, meaning the response of an immune system, and what happens to our neurodegenerative processes is going to explode. And finally, I think our cancer and autoimmune disorder treatments are going to get more refined. Right now, for as many strides as we've made, there's a lot of collateral damage that comes from these immunotherapies you've heard about, and that I discussed in the case of Jason. So I would say stay tuned on all of that stuff.
Your book explores vaccines, antibiotics, T cells, B cells, and much, much more. It is endlessly fascinating and so very well written. An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System, A Tale in Four Lives, published by William Morrow, the author, Matt Richtel. Matt Richtel, thank you so much. I was honored to speak with you, and I loved your book.
Have a great day, Greg.
This book was published in 2019. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you will hear the interview that I recorded with actor Robert Bathurst from Downton Abbey, talking about the series of novels by Louise Penny, for which he has recorded the audio versions. We had a really fun conversation about that. The most recent novel by Louise Penny is called The Madness of Crowds. Also tomorrow, Roseanne Shales and Gwida Brown, who are president and vice president, respectively, of the Kenosha Women's Network, which is about to celebrate its 40th anniversary. On Thursday, we're hoping that Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program will be airing with a show featuring Ben Benninghoff from the Wisconsin DNR. On Friday, a busy day, which will include a preview of this weekend's performances of Shakespeare's Hamlet by the Fleeing Artists Company, and a preview of the American Experience documentary airing Monday evening, which chronicles the life and career and legacy of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. We're approaching 9 o'clock.